Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. This is Travis. Maybe I'm at 95% of my lung capacity pre-COVID, still getting better. And I thought it would be kind of fun to look back at better times today, the past, right? It seems like there's tons of nostalgia in the air. I've seen a lot of stuff about the 80s, the 90s. Backstreet Boys is going on tour randomly. I saw they're coming to town in a few months. It just seems like there's a lot of sitcoms on TV for the holidays that are like old sitcoms having current modern day big name actors appear, you know, as different roles. So it seems like everybody loves nostalgia. I thought I'd kind of do a little bit of a throwback to what I would have done differently, what we would have done differently with my wife's student loan strategy if I could redo everything knowing what I know now. Out of fairness, I want to say that this is the 2016 version of Travis. Actually, I have to walk that back, actually. Technically, the 2015 version of me, where we had just started dating and we started getting more serious and we talked about finances. And the thing that kind of came up was, for her debt, because it was pretty large. Large for me, but not really large at all when compared to a lot of people. So she had about $124,000 of loans for med school. And the reason that she only had that much was because her parents took out a lot of debt themselves to try to help support her going through medical school so she would come out with less debt. That delayed their retirement maybe a little bit. You know, she's an only child, so it's kind of like that was the big point, is to sacrifice financially so that she could have the smallest burden possible coming out of medical school, right? My wife and I met when she was in her last year of fellowship. She was getting ready to apply to jobs and sort of getting ready to apply to positions. And it might have been second to last year of fellowship, actually. I can't remember 100%. But basically, she'd already passed residency. And as you all know, residency and fellowship is a time that can count for public service loan forgiveness. So her interests were very much in academic medicine. And I was like, wow, you want to... Initially, I thought, oh, you just pay the loans back. But I found out about PSLF from doing some research and talking to some people. And I thought, wow, this is such a great program. Instead of us having to pay back this whole six-figure loan balance, we're going to get most of it all forgiven because she's already got 7 years of credit, having done 4 years of residency, 3 years of fellowship. But then Fed Loan entered our lives. And Fed Loan sent her a response when I asked her to apply for it. They replied back that not only did she not have 7 years, on one set of loans, she had 3 years, and on another set of loans, she had 0 years. And I thought, how is that possible? Are you kidding? And it turns out that in 2012, I think at the end of her residency, she realized that she had the wrong kind of loans, or someone did, and recommended that to her that she consolidate them into direct federal student loans. And in so doing, she made them eligible for PSLF, but obviously payments on FFEL loans don't count. So instead of having credit from all the way from 2008, she had 3 years of credit on those loans that she consolidated in 2012. And then she had zero credit, or actually maybe 1 month of credit somehow, on her loans from that period in, the ones, I guess, that were maybe consolidated later. I'm not really clear, to be honest with you, about the status of those loans that only had 1 month of credit instead of 3 years. I think that they just like miscounted. I think maybe some of those were consolidation loans. Maybe some of those other loans were just straight up direct Stafford loans or something. So they didn't have the correct amount of credit on the overall loan balance. On the loans that were consolidated in 2012, they did. Anyways, we're looking at that. We're thinking, oh, nuts. You know, instead of having, you know, 7 years of credit where we're only 3 years away, our plan was, well, okay, well, if we got married, then she would hit the payment cap. But remember that the cap on IBR and pay-as-you-earn is just the standard 10-year plan. So the cap on the standard 10-year plan for her loans would have been about $1,200 a month. That would mean that we would get maybe $80,000, $90,000 of that forgiven tax-free. So there was that issue. Then we sort of thought, well, okay, if we're doing 7 years worth of standard 10-year plan payments, is that really worth it? So on the loans that had 3 years of credit, is it worth keeping those loans around another 7 years with the standard 10-year plan? And, you know, looking at the math, the difference was perhaps maybe $5,000 or $10,000. Like when I was running the math, and then again, this was me in 2015 with not nearly the level of experience that I have now, but just running the numbers, it seemed to me that there wasn't a whole lot of difference if we did get forgiveness, we would be getting it on some sort of like $20,000 type amount. And that was not attractive enough to us at the time to keep the loans around. We wanted the debt out of our lives to kind of move on and just have financial options that didn't include waiting around for loan forgiveness. Some would say that that makes me a hypocrite since we do tell a lot of people to go for loan forgiveness. I would say that just makes me more informed now than I was back then. I think a whole lot of people come to the table thinking, oh, I'm going to pay this off. This is going to be no problem at all. I've got to pay this off. It's the right thing to do. Or it's, you know, what I feel like I have to do, right? Now, in reality, my wife was doing a lot of research-related topics too. I didn't know something called the NIH Loan Forgiveness Program existed. If you're doing a bunch of research, you know, especially in fellowship, you can look into that program. That can help pay some of your debt back. So we didn't really know about that program until it was too late as well. That said, what would have happened if we had just done nothing? What would have happened if we had just kept certifying for PSLF? What would have occurred? Think about this. She made payments in 2008 and sometime was probably in and out of forbearance a whole lot. I think she told me that, like when she was in New York, it was very expensive. She didn't have $300 a month, even as a resident. So she was in and out of forbearance all the time. And so, yeah, that generated a lot of months of not qualifying. But think about this. If we had done nothing and just stayed on the income-based plan, around 2018 was the year that she would have had a tax return from 2017 reflecting her full attending income. So 2018 is the very first year, probably in the latter part of that year as well. So maybe let's say November or December of 2018, she would have had a payment finally based on the standard 10-year plan. So that payment would have been about $1,200 a month. That payment would have lasted from $1,200 a month. It would have lasted until March of 2020. So she effectively would have made maybe 14 or 15 payments of $1,200 a month. And then the pandemic would have happened. And then all of her payments and interest would have been paused. But she would still be getting credit. And at the end of the pandemic, or whenever, it's not over completely yet, I guess, right? But whenever that PSLF waiver gets processed, what would have happened is, since she had previously consolidated FFEL loans, then those months of credit would have counted towards the 120 that she needed. So she actually never would have made a payment ever again on those loans. So if you think about it, her IBR payment was around $300-$500 a month, something like that. So that $300-$500 a month payment would have lasted from 2015 until late 2018. So holistically there's about 3 years there. So she would have paid maybe around $4,000 a year times 3 years. That's about $12,000. And then add in $1,200 a month payments for, let's say, about 15 months. So what is that? Around like $18,000. So $18,000 plus $12,000 is $30,000. If we had literally done nothing, literally sat on our butts and continued filing our ECF forms, but, you know, just done IBR, not worried about filing separately or jointly or anything like that, because she wasn't eligible for pay as you earn, literally just did nothing, we would have paid $30,000 towards her student loans. This is even with the Fed loan mess up of like calculating the payments wrong on some of the loans and other loans. It was more correct, right? So we would have paid $30,000 and we would have had the rest forgiven. So instead of paying back, we paid $124,000 plus interest, right? So we paid maybe $135,000 back total. We could have paid $30,000. And also her parents, by the way, probably borrowed maybe $100,000 or $150,000 or something like that to help subsidize her medical school. And, you know, that number is not reflected in the amount that she had to borrow. So maybe consider that that's, let's say, $230,000 to $250,000 total that she would have borrowed. So we could have paid $30,000. So my wife and I, because we refinanced our loans, because we didn't know that this pandemic was going to happen, because we didn't know the PSLF waiver was going to happen, we ended up costing ourselves $200,000 between ourselves and her parents. So I'm sure that some of you on this call have lost more money than that on student loan strategies that were unoptimized. You know, obviously, if you refinanced $500,000 of student loans when you could have gotten PSLF, that would be a pretty bad example of that, right? If you refinanced right before March 2020 and lost out on 22 months, maybe more, we'll talk about that later, of interest freezing, then that would stink, There's no question about it. But I don't know if that makes you feel like you can't trust me more or you can trust me more, that we personally lost $200,000 because of suboptimal advice on student loans. Now, that is really quite interesting, right? Because who tends to take out other forms of debt to avoid student debt for student loans? Disproportionately immigrant families. I can't tell you how many consults that I've experienced where, you know, someone has half of the cost of attendance in student loans instead of all of it. And the reason is because their parents, who are first generation, mortgaged their house right before retirement with the expectation that once that person graduated and got a job, that they would help support them in their old age. My wife's Asian American. That's just a very common experience that I've seen with all kinds of immigrant families, Asian Americans, you know, just folks from Latin American countries. Like, it's just really African countries as well. It seems like it's a very kind of like non-born in America kind of thing, where like you have this expectation that the parents will take care of the kids will take care of the parents financially, and that's just how it works. So a thing like the PS Love program that was designed to help people, help physicians like my wife, ended up not helping her, right? And because of all the mess and all the bureaucracy and all the problems, we lost, I guess, what would have bought us, it used to buy a house, $200,000 used to buy a house. Now it buys what, like a studio apartment in rural America? I don't know. But that's a lot of money to lose. So hopefully that makes you feel better, that 2015 version of me lost that kind of money on a suboptimal loan forgiveness program. And I will say this, because of our aggressive saving and investing that my wife and I have done, which we teach people how to do in our six-figure debt to six-figure net worth investing course, which, by the way, is coming out in early January. Because we've done that, because we've done the assets and the savings and the investing the right way, and because we have worked to use our educations to generate incomes from those educations, we're way better off, and the student loans are kind of like a rounding error. And I don't say that to be braggadocious or something, but because I want that for you. So many times people get so caught up in, oh my gosh, if I had known this about student loans at this point, or if I had known this about student loans when I was 25, right, or 18, or whatever it is, my life would be so different now. And that might be true, but consider that a good savings and investing strategy and being aware of what you're doing can be a lot more powerful than even getting the perfect loan cancellation or loan forgiveness story. It's kind of funny, because one of the good things that happened about our PSLF, failed PSLF journey for me and my wife, is I met one of my friends, Josh from biglawinvestor.com. His wife had PSLF eligible loans as well. She was a public defender, and he wrote an article about how they had planned to refinance it because they determined that she couldn't qualify. I commented on his blog, hey, did you know that, you know, you can file jointly and not have a huge tax penalty from filing separately, and you can just cap the payments at the standard 10-year plan? And he's like, wait, really? And we started chatting, and now he's one of my best buddies. So that was kind of cool, except guess what happened? She quit and started an amazing Etsy store and really enjoys doing that. So she wouldn't have qualified for PSLF because she didn't stay 10 years in that qualifying employer. And my wife did. So beware of my advice, folks, right? My wife didn't get PSLF. I told somebody to do PSLF, and she didn't get it because of a career choice that she made, my friend's wife. My advice was wrong in both instances. The good news is, for both of us, we were thinking about our loans in the context of our overall financial picture. And that is what made that journey successful from a financial monetary standpoint. I've been telling people right now that are in potential public service type roles to be careful about refinancing. I think I've got some news for you on that front. So the final round of negotiated rulemaking is completed. And this is the process that every couple of years, especially under Democratic administrations, the Department of Education tries to meet and come up with new regulations to make new income-based programs, make new forgiveness guidelines, basically to try to make student loans more generous for borrowers. So far, at least, as far as I'm aware, the only people that have done negotiated rulemaking have been President Obama and President Biden. So it's been a very, you know, borrower-focused kind of thing. And so far, you've had things like pay-as-you-earn and revised pay-as-you-earn come out of those meetings. this latest version, what we were potentially watching for is, was the definition of public service going to be expanded to include a whole bunch more of the folks in the workforce than who currently qualify for it? So the thing that we were considering is, well, there's a lot of people that work at for-profit hospitals or for-profit physician groups that could qualify for public service loan forgiveness if the definition of qualifying employment was expanded. Same thing with nurses that work at for-profit hospitals. Obviously, what's the difference between a nurse working at a for-profit hospital owned by HCA and one across the street working at Catholic Charities or, you know, Catholic Hospital of Ohio or something like that, right? It's the same freaking job. The only difference is one nurse qualifies for loan forgiveness and one doesn't. And that's not very fair. I mean, it's, life's not fair, but that's kind of a very obviously unfair thing. You know, somebody that does IT for a for-profit hospital system and a not-for-profit hospital system does the same job. What happened with this definition? Basically, the Department of Education said that they want to be able to administer it easily, and to not have a clear definition as to who is a public servant means that you're going by a borrower-by-borrower basis where there wouldn't be an equitable definition where people could go off of. And so that's why they're uncomfortable expanding the definition of qualifying employment beyond the not-for-profit and government definitions. This is tentative. We haven't seen the final regulations yet, but it seems like if you're a Kaiser Permanente physician or a nurse at a for-profit hospital, does not seem like you're going to qualify for PSLF. It does not seem like the definition of qualifying employment is going to be expanded. It seems like also contractors will probably get left out. People that are 1099 that happen to be employed by organizations that contract out to the government, for example, that seems like that's not going to be qualifying employment either. One positive thing going on with this negotiated rulemaking process, though, is it seems like certain kinds of forbearances and deferments might count now towards PSLF. Now, that is really interesting because if you think about my wife's issues going in and out of forbearance and deferment during residency, she would have loved to have the option to do residency deferment the whole time, all the way through 7 years of training. And under the current potential guidelines they might be releasing for PSLF, for the future, you might be able to defer your loans for 7 years in residency and fellowship and have all 7 years of that count towards PSLF. That's a huge deal. But there's some issues and unintended consequences that I expect could come up with this. What I mean is, if you're doing the revised pay-as-you-earn program, you get interest subsidies. If you're doing a deferment, you don't. For somebody in residency that doesn't know yet if they want to go for-profit or not-for-profit, if you defer, you're going to lose out on that 50% interest subsidy in residency. And if you have $400,000 in loans, then that could be substantial. You're talking about maybe $30,000 of interest charges a year. On the repay plan, you get half of it subsidized, right? So you're talking about a $15,000 per year interest subsidy, maybe over 7 years, as residencies and fellowships can often be that long. And suddenly you missed out on six figures of interest subsidies. Same problem could potentially happen depending on how they treat forbearance and deferment for income-based repayment. If you're in a forbearance or deferment for income-based repayment, will that qualify for just PSLF or also the 20 and 25 year versions of forgiveness? Because think about a scenario where you are planning to become a family medicine doctor and you defer your loans for those first 3 years. Well, if you ended up going for the 20-year version of forgiveness because you find a nice job at a family practice, you would not be able to get forgiveness if as soon as you should be getting it if you deferred potentially, depending on how they end up doing the rules. And so there could be a scenario where if you're 100% sure you're going a nonprofit or government, you know, full-time role, then you would defer or forbear your loans in residency and fellowship. However, if you were at all uncertain, then you would want to continue, you would want to make payments on that $100, $200, $300 a month amount that they tend to ask for. So this is going to create a lot of issues. The other thing that's happening is the income-driven repayment plan that they're trying to figure out. The negotiated rulemaking process generally consists of a bunch of folks representing specific interest groups that if they come to a consensus, then the regulations are just adopted. If they don't come to a consensus, then it's really unpredictable as to what's going to happen. So the Department of Education had a very different idea, I think, as to what they wanted to do with this negotiated rulemaking. Completely different. And you know, and this is just my guess. I think the negotiated rulemaking was very I think the sort of progressive wing of the Democratic Party was very overrepresented on this negotiated rulemaking committee compared to past committees. This, I don't know if this is true or not. This is just the sense that I got, that there's a lot of like hardcore progressive, like Warren Sanders type folks on the committee. And you've got a Department of Education that's kind of like that moderate Biden type of wing of the party that's just trying to be super cautious. That's just my thought, because one of the people on Twitter said that, like, this is like, they quoted somebody on the committee saying, like, this is the farthest apart the Department of Education and the negotiated rulemaking committee have ever been on making regulations for student loans. Like, that's just like night and day. Like, and it kind of is. Like, so the negotiators wanted, like, they wanted everything. I mean, it was really like kind of awesome if you're a borrower, like seeing how hard these people fought for getting more forgiveness for you. Like, they were like, well, we want, instead of 150% of the poverty line as a deduction, we want 400% of the poverty line as a deduction. So a family making $100,000 a year, a family of four would pay $0 a month in that case. Instead of 20 years till forgiveness, some people wanted 7 years towards forgiveness or 10 years towards forgiveness, mirroring the PSLF program. Some people said 15 years would be okay, right? But I mean, it was very aggressive. I was a little shocked, like coming out of the gate, hearing that their asks for the IDR plan, they didn't hold back. And then Department of Education came back to them and said, well, here's our plan. We're going to do 200% of the poverty line instead of 150. So people making, you know, $40,000 a year with a kid might not have to pay anything. And then for 200 to 300% of the poverty line, you'll pay 5% of your income. And then from above 300% of the poverty line, you'll pay 10% of your income. So for most of our audience, for our graduate professional audience, that would mean that you would pay approximately $100 less a month in your student loans. That's not a difference really much at all. That would not influence any big refinancing or forgiveness decisions. In fact, this new EICR plan that they're still trying to figure out the name for, they also restricted it to only undergrads in the first draft of the rulemaking. The reason being is because Department of Education is concerned that most of the defaults happen with people that have undergrad degrees. And you know what, guys? It's true. I think that it's kind of weird that they would leave out graduate school borrowers. But if you look at graduate school borrowers versus undergrad borrowers, the biggest problem in the student loan system, there's really multiple problems with it, right? But probably one of the bigger problems is people that make $20,000 a year that are really confused by the whole process. And they end up having to pay the standard plan, which is like $100 a month, and they can't afford that. And then they go into default. And then instead of their earned income tax credit being this great refund that catches them up on like late rent and bills and things that they need to pay, then that earned income tax credit gets seized effectively by the Department of Education to capture the money they're supposed to pay for their student loans. I tell you what, I remember when we were getting a lot of traffic during the beginning part of the pandemic, there were so many people flooding our site, like asking questions about that specifically. And I just really kind of don't think about it, I guess, that much, because our audience does tend to be that professional audience that is making comfortably over $30,000 a year. And there's a lot of people out there that are making less than that, that have student loans, that were promised the moon with some useless bachelor's degree or useless associate's degree, right, from a for-profit college, or maybe from just a straight-up college that just is useless or not that helpful. Then they graduate, or they have like some years of college and they have no difference in their earnings and a bunch of debt that they feel like they shouldn't have to pay on because it wasn't useful to them. And then that debt just ruins their life because they get their refunds seized, they get their credit wrecked, and that stinks. And so the Department of Education was looking at that problem versus the other problem, which is a real problem, which is runaway debt amounts and just people feeling trapped that they're in debt forever. Because let's be honest, the 10 to 50,000 cancellation, that wouldn't have helped our community that much, right? Like, you're a part-time social worker with 200,000 of student loan debt. If they did 50,000 of cancellation, like, great, but like, big whoop. You still got another 150 to go. And if you're part-time, you don't qualify for PSLF. So what are your options? It's absolutely a huge problem. Student debt's a huge problem in this country. High debt relative to income is a super big problem. The issue is there's no easy fix, right? Anybody who says it's an easy fix is, like, I think being disingenuous. Like, if fixing student loans was easy, it would have been done already. Right. And basically nobody wants to piss anybody off. And so everybody kind of just punts. And so that's kind of what's going on right now. Right. Like, like some article in the Wall Street Journal, I think I saw like some article, they quoted somebody and they were like, yeah, we don't really know how to fix it. We know we messed it up, but we don't know what the fix is. So we just ignore it. That's somebody, an aide in Congress basically said that. I was like, wow, that's really insightful. So the people making the new regulations, the committee members that are proposing new regulations, they're pretty upset. Department of Education wanted, I think, praise and admiration for the work that they put in. And they're unhappy, I think, because of how unhappy the committee is at them. So it's a big cluster. You know, I guess the main thing to come out of this is forbearance and deferment for PSLF might be counting at some point, which is that's pretty exciting. That's positive. And then some other positives like consolidation might not reset the clock for PSLF. That's decent, but it's all kind of minor compared to the waiver, the PSLF expansion waiver, where they're just like, back up the truck, let's just count everything. You know, to be honest, I'm really, for the people benefiting from the PSLF waiver, I'm glad for you that you're benefiting from it, because I honestly think like this was like put together in a hurry just to try to like get this out the door as fast as they could before, you know, this emergency authority window closes. Because that's really what's going to happen, is once they don't have that emergency authority window to make all these claims for what they can do with student loans, it's going to go in the back burner again. It's probably not going to be brought up for a while. So it's kind of like status quo, I think. The National Emergency Authority in the HEROES Act of 2003 was used to the extreme during this pandemic, right? Not as much as it maybe could have been, but I think President Biden brought up canceling $100 billion of student loans through that waiver in this past year alone, just because he paused interest and he counted payments that could count towards forgiveness, paused payments still counting towards forgiveness. So that's like $100 billion. That's a lot of money. And the interesting thing about it is that a lot of the benefit disproportionately went to people that have the highest incomes and the highest debt amounts, if we're honest about it. I think that there might be another benefit potentially coming towards those folks, towards you guys that have federal loans. This is a possibility. This is not something, so let me say this. This is just based off of a letter that I saw that 14 Democratic senators sent to President Biden about student loan repayments. So let me pause and say, like, maybe something has come out like in the time between I recorded this and when we had this go live where there's clarity around this, but it's something that I just wanted to mention. So it seems to me that Senator Warren and Senator Schumer have this pattern of sort of 60 days before the end of the interest and payments freeze, they come out and say, like, we need to cancel debt, we need to extend it. They've done that consistently, basically the entire pandemic. What you have to look at to see what might actually happen is, what do the other Democratic senators do? Because I don't doubt that Schumer and Warren believe in what they're saying, but I also think that they are doing it strategically, right? I think Senator Schumer wants to make sure there's no chance of a left flank challenge in a primary against him from somebody like, you know, Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, right? So this is an easy issue for him. He knows cancellation is not going to happen. He can say he's for it when he doesn't really have to worry about, you know, being for it, because he knows it's not going to happen. So you look for that pattern. So they came out and did that, but 14 other Democratic senators came out and said what they want is that payments would start January 31st, but interest would not. And what they said is this HEROES Act of 2003, they are claiming that student loan repayment would be easier, that the transition into repayment would be easier if they suspended interest but not payments, because they want to get payments going but not interest. And that's interesting, because what they said in that letter is that based on the HEROES Act of 2003, the president has this authority during a national emergency to do this. That's true. That's the authority that both President Trump and President Biden relied on during this pandemic to pause payments and interest. So if Biden wanted to, he could start payments on January 31st, but not interest. Why could he do that? Because this is based on a national emergency declaration or authority. I'm not clear as to how they are supposed to define that, but that is the rule. So it's up to President Biden if he listens to these 14 Democratic senators. That's a large number of Democratic senators. It's mostly more of the left wing of the party. Although, you know, someone like a Senator Sanders wasn't on it, I'm sure he would support it. But there was also a couple notable people not on it. So the chairwoman of the Senate Education Committee, her name was not on it. Also, from an operational standpoint, it would be very difficult to start payments but not interest, just because you have to calculate a payment and amortization schedule based on an interest rate. If you have an interest rate of zero, yeah, you're just dividing it by whatever, but you know, how do you calculate the correct standard 10-year payment if you're not allowed to use the interest rate in that calculation, right? Like if you have a standard 10-year payment that's $1,200 a month, if a 0% interest rate would make it $1,000 a month for standard 10-year amortization, are you supposed to pay the $1,200? Are you supposed to tell the borrower they have to pay the $1,200 and you'll count the extra $200 towards principal, or you have to pay $1,000 because that's the amount without the interest? In other words, it sounds like really easy, but operationally, it's not easy. So is there a chance that they would do this? I think that there is a real chance. So here's kind of why. And if they have announced that they're doing this, then, you know, then my prediction ended up happening. I'm not saying like for sure this is going to happen, by the way. I just want to say like it's maybe a 50-50 kind of thing. The reason I think they might do it is this, right? This is sort of I'm trying to channel my inner 538 here. It seems quite likely, according to political observers, that Democrats will lose at least one chamber of Congress in 2022, because that usually happens. The party in power tends to lose one or both chambers of Congress in the midterm election. So they're kind of counting on this. And what do you do if you are a Democratic congressperson or senator up for re-election? You have to show you've delivered for your voters, or else they're going to stay home. And what have they failed to do? They promised $10,000 of student loan cancellation, and have they delivered on that? No. Especially for the average person on the street. The average person on the street has gotten their small Stafford loan interest subsidized and their $100 a month payment paused, but not the debt. That's what people want gone. They want the debt gone. If you canceled $50,000 of debt, you're canceling debt for the vast majority of people, and it's out of their lives, right? So from a political standpoint, since one voter gets one vote, that's a very efficient strategy for making voters happy, is eliminating their debt, right? But the Democrats have not done that. And why have they not done that? Because they can't do it via legislation, because it's too expensive given their 50-vote majority in the Senate, right? So you can't get it through Congress. You could say you could, but you can't, just because they're, you know, Joe Manchin's he's the deciding senator, right? He's from one of the least educated states in the whole country. And so he's just not going to do that, because his working class voters are going to say, well, why can't you cancel $10,000 of my credit card debt, or $10,000 of my mortgage, or $10,000 of my car loan that I can't afford? Not going to happen through Congress. So then could President Biden do it via executive order? You can say you can do anything via executive order, right? What happens is what happens when somebody sues you and challenges it in the courts. So say he does the $10,000 via executive order. I've talked about this for a while. The problem with that is what happened with the eviction and moratorium extension that he did. Remember that? That's when he said he couldn't extend the moratorium any longer on evicting people due to non-payment during the pandemic. And Congresswoman Cori Bush, who's one of the progressive wing members of the Democratic Party, she sort of staged a sit. I don't know. It's not really a sit-in. It's sort of like a sleep-in, I guess, on the steps of the Congress to try to highlight the issue. And sort of, I think, was very effective in sort of shaming Biden into extending it, even though he had just had a Supreme Court case where they explicitly stated, like, this is not constitutional, but we're going to let it last till the end of the month, right? And so Biden just went ahead and extended the moratorium anyway, because he knew that it would take a few weeks to get through the courts, and so maybe that would buy people some extra time. And then what happened is the Supreme Court struck it down, said this was unconstitutional, now limits his future power for doing something like that. Say we went back into a worse pandemic. That's why they didn't do it via executive orders, because they looked at the legal arguments, they looked at the composition of the current Supreme Court, and they said, we can't get it by these folks. That's my guess. So since they haven't delivered on those things, what do you do? Well, you extended the interest and payment pause until September 30th. And then, because you did no work trying to get the servicers ready for repayments, and because, you know, you extended the payment and interest pause until January 31st, ostensibly to buy yourself more time to help prepare for a smooth reentry into repayment, as well as finishing up this negotiated rulemaking process to issue some new relief and regulations around PSLF and things like that. They've already stated this is going to be the final extension of the payment and interest pause. If they extend it again, then they're going to have a big default problem on their hands at some point when they do ask people to start again. Because if you say it's going to be the final one and then you don't do it, then nobody believes you and student loans are due again, is just my interpretation. So they can't not do anything January 31st. But what they might do is, if Omicron cases continue to rise and the pandemic just continues to drag on, if not grow a little bit in cases from here, then they might say, well, that's enough of a justification for us to extend the interest pause until the end of the national emergency. And so what does that mean? End of the national emergency? I think there's a chance that they extend the interest freeze for maybe 3 months until April or March, kind of like what they did with the TSA, right? They extended the mask mandate on airports and planes for another 2 or 3 months, right? Because of Omicron. There's a chance it could be that. I think the worst case, or actually I should say best case, right? Best case for borrowers that have federal loans would be that he would extend it like he did for the PSLF waiver until October 31st, 2022. So there's a possibility that they do that. There's also the very likely scenario where they don't do that because of the complexity, because moderates didn't sign on to that letter, because they don't support it, right? Because they do feel like that they need things to look normal again, that voters are not reminded that there's still a pandemic anymore going into 2022. Otherwise, they're going to lose even bigger margins and have even bigger problems with a very Republican Congress instead of just a marginally Republican Congress. So it's hard to say, right? But I think that there's a chance that there's some kind of extension on the interest. Now, with the interest rates that people are currently getting, is that big of a deal? I would say it depends on what your risk tolerance is. So if you get offered a great deal with the possibility that there could be one that's as good offered later, then some people are okay waiting. Some people, though, they get offered a great deal and they're like, you know what, I don't want to risk losing this deal. And so I want to just hit the bid and move on with my life. One kind of thing that I'm seeing is people are getting rates in the low twos and low threes right now with refinancing. That was not the case like earlier on in my career. 3 years ago, I think people were getting like 5.5 for 20-year fixed rates. I mean, just really lousy, high rates. And the rates have really plummeted like crazy, you know, in the past couple years with COVID having interest rates just be like an anchor. I mean, that's what really COVID is doing. COVID's kind of like an anchor on interest rates. So the 10-year treasury is at 1.5%. A few years ago, it was like 3-something. So it's kind of ironic because it's like refinancing kind of depends on treasury rates being low. You're suspending interest, but if you suspend it longer until the end of the national kind of emergency, you know, then interest rates would probably go up a lot. And then you'd be dealing with having to deal with like 5% rate on your refinance for 10 years or 20 years instead of a 3. You know, if your plan is to apply like in early January or something, then I think you're in good shape to continue doing that and just kind of monitor the situation. You know, I don't think that they're going to be able to announce this a couple weeks before the pause. If they're definitely starting payments again, they'd have to give a lot of notice on the interest pause. Like they'd have to say it in early January, right? I don't know. I think that people that are thinking about refinancing can still refinance if you're comfortable with saying, okay, if I got a 2.5 for 10 years and they unexpectedly announced another 6-month extension of the interest freeze, maybe my 10-year rate at the end of that 6 months would have been 3.5%, right? Or 4%. And then therefore locking in that low rate was worth it. So those are some of the thoughts that I have. But also, if you have private student loans, you can get way lower interest rates right now. Probably, even if you applied 6 months ago, you probably can still find lower rates, just because it's like unbelievable the amount of competition that I'm seeing in the refinancing market. It's really nothing like I've ever seen before. So if you want to apply for a lower interest rate on your federal or private student loans, one of the companies that we work with is Splash Financial. Splash shops rates from a lot of different lenders, including credit unions, major lenders in the marketplace, puts it all through their algorithm and tries to find you the best deal. And they're one of the big providers of a lot of these very low interest rates that we're seeing in the market. So if you want to check with them what your rate could be, go to studentloanplanner.com/splash. So that's studentloanplanner.com/splash. If you go there, you'll get, if you refinance at least $50,000, you'll get a $300 cash bonus. If you refinance at least $100,000, you'll get a $1,000 cash bonus. If you're refinancing that amount, I would highly suggest reaching out to help@studentloanplanner.com and let us know when you apply so we can put your info down in our tracking sheet for that higher cash bonus. think about what the right thing to do is long-term with your student loans and know that that long-term approach very rarely changes. So again, if you wanted to apply to check your rate, studentloanplanner.com/splash. Obviously, if you want to book a consult, feel free to do that or reach out to us if you have any questions. And remember to ask just your questions in general for the podcast. You can send them via email or our podcast voicemail. I'd love to hear from you with all the kind of things going on. And of course, I wish you a wonderful holiday season with family. Hope it recharges you. I hope that you don't think about the pandemic too much and you don't check your New York Times daily cases like I do way too often. And you just really enjoy this wonderful gift of time that we've all been given. So thank you, everybody, and I hope you have a great rest of your week.